Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is James C. Groves. I have the privilege of appearing pro hoc vice. My DC bar number is 480630.
And you filed that paperwork already?
Yes, Your Honor, and it was great.
Okay, thank you.
And I also understand that there could be explosions after 9 a.m., so...
We're the government.
We're a little bit more jittery about that in D.C., so I'll try to maintain our course here.
It's not explosions, but some cannon fire.
Right. As the court is aware, the appeal and the cross-appeal in this case raise a number of issues. For purposes of our conversation this morning, we hope to focus the court's attention on what we believe is the primary issue on which the court can and should resolve this case in its entirety, and that is on the issue of legal causation. Of course, when we speak of causation in this case, we do so in the context of a cause of action under the state wrongful death statute, which, in abrogating the common law prohibition against civil claims for death, created the unwaivable and immovable requirement that the plaintiff prove that the defendant's negligence caused the decedent's death and not just some form of injury.
Does it have to be a cause or the cause?
It has to be for factual causation purposes, it has to be only a cause. I think that's consistent with the Colorado case.
Is that different than legal causation?
Yes, Your Honor, I think it is.
So for legal causation, does it have to be the cause? Is that what you're saying?
No, Your Honor. I think that what we're saying on legal causation is that even assuming that there is but for causation as opposed to establish factual causation, that does not end the causal inquiry. The inquiry then becomes whether, essentially as a matter of public policy, whether the alleged negligence of the defendant still constitutes a legal, I don't want to use legal cause in defining the standard, I apologize. Should be seen still as the responsible actor for causing the injury sustained. And so as this court's decision in Moore explains, the factual causation inquiry and the legal causation inquiry are two separate inquiries. Of course, our briefs challenge factual causation in this case, but for purposes of our conversation this morning, we'd like to focus on legal causation. This court, as far as we can tell, has not yet resolved the legal consequences of a medical patient's decision to discontinue life-saving medical treatment, nor can we find any authority from the Supreme Court of Colorado that has addressed that issue. So it appears to be a question of first impression.
Isn't it primarily a question of fact? I mean, your expert said she would have gotten better, and the plaintiff's expert said she was already dying. And how can we superimpose a legal analysis on disputed evidence that the jury heard?
If there was, in fact, a factual question, Your Honor, we would agree with you that it would be a causation, even legal causation, would be a question for the jury. We respectfully submit that there, in fact, is no material question of fact on the relevant issue. Now, as Your Honor pointed out, our expert, Dr. Schwartz, said that it would have been easy for the decedent to have been restored to her pre-negligence clinical condition. Dr. Leach, plaintiff's causation expert, testified on page 222 of the May 1st trial transcript, and this is, I think, a critical portion of the record. Even Dr. Leach said, it takes a little bit more antibiotic. Those are his words. In discussing the consequences of the decedent's decision to discontinue medical treatment in this case. So even plaintiff's expert said that continuation of antibiotic treatment would have resolved this issue.
Where did the plaintiff's expert say that?
It's on the May 1st, 2013 trial transcript, page 222. So, as we explained in our answer reply brief, we don't believe there is a question of fact. I'd also like to address the issue preservation argument that's made by plaintiff. As I understand it, the contention made by plaintiff is that we were required to ask the trial judge to give a jury instruction on this issue. That only would have been required if, in fact, there was a question of material fact. And because there was not, Rule 59E says that we were well within our rights to raise this issue in our motion for judgment, notwithstanding the verdict.
Is Is this an issue of comparative negligence?
No.
There was no request for comparative negligence instruction, was there?
I don't believe so, no, Your Honor. And I don't believe it is a question of comparative negligence.
Why not?
Comparative negligence, as I understand it in this state, would be implicated. Well, let me put it this way. I don't think we've never made the argument that the decision to discontinue medical treatment was a negligent decision on the part of the decedent. So that would seem to be a condition precedent to a comparative negligence argument.
Did you preserve this in a motion for a directed verdict?
No, Your Honor, it was not asserted in a motion for a directed verdict.
Do you have to have a motion for a directed verdict before you can move on the same grounds for a judgment notwithstanding the verdict?
Not as I read the plain language of Rule 59-8. Granted, I think that the express language in 59-8 that says a motion for a directed verdict is not a condition precedent to making arguments in a JNOV motion. Now, certainly, I think that's a fairly, at least in my experience, Colorado's fairly unique in that regard. I think federal rule is certainly different. But plain language of Rule 59E provides that we were fully within our rights to raise this issue in a motion for judgment notwithstanding the verdict. Now, on the merits of this issue, recognizing that it's a question of first impression, we've tried our best to analogize to existing case law of this court. And in doing so, have focused on this court's relatively recent decision in the Moore case, which involved the question of legal causation in the context of a decedent who was alleged to have suffered severe emotional trauma as a result of his employer's decision to contest workers' comp benefits, and that decedent committed suicide, and a wrongful death claim arose out of that case. This court, in affirming summary judgment in that case on the question of legal causation, focused on the issue or the question of whether the decedent's decision in that case was voluntary and determined that it was not involuntary. The same is true here. No argument has been made on appeal that the decedent's decision was involuntary. No decision or no argument was made below to that effect. In fact, Moore does not get cited or addressed at all in plaintiff's briefs. And so we think that although Moore does not necessarily compel the conclusion in this case, and obviously it doesn't because it's a panel decision of this court, we think it provides ample authority for the court to agree with us on the merits of that issue. And if the court does so, of course, it necessarily follows that not only would the compensatory damages aspect of the judgment below be reversed, but it necessarily follows that any punitive damage award would be reversed as well. I don't understand plaintiff to have contested our assertion in that regard. It seems fairly well established in Colorado that you have to have a valid claim for compensatory damages in order to have a claim for punitive damages.
Is it your position that Dr. Leach unequivocally conceded that had the deceased continued the antibiotic regimen, she would not have died?
I interpret, yes, Your Honor, and let me, if I can explain why. I interpret his statement, I think the clear import of his statement, that it takes a little bit, you know, antibiotic, those are his words, and I'm trying to flip by saying, you know, that he is saying, even if the court accepts his theory, and his theory was, urinary tract infection led to blood infection. That's his theory. Mm-hmm. And in the course of giving that opinion, he says it takes a little bit more, in referring specifically to the decedent, not generally speaking, he's referring to the decedent in this case. He says it takes a little bit more, you know, antibiotic. So I think there's a reasonable interpretation of that statement that at a minimum, he's not contesting are later showing through Dr. Schwartz that it would have been easy to restore this woman to her pre-negligence condition. But I think one can perhaps even go further in saying it's supportive of that conclusion. And therefore, since there's no contrary evidence on that issue, it makes it a question of law for the court to resolve. If there are no further questions on that issue, I'd like to briefly touch upon the other question of first impression in this case. That's why I fly here from DC. I enjoy questions of first impression. I'm sure the court may not enjoy them as much as I do. This court has not resolved a challenge to a prospective juror. When that prospective juror says, you know what, the defendant physically harmed a close family member of mine in the exact same way that the plaintiff is alleging that the decedent was harmed.
Did the juror say that Belmont harmed his father, or simply say that his father suffered one or possibly more UTIs while he was a patient or resident at Belmont, as his father had also suffered or contracted UTIs in other facilities?
I think he did say that in the following sense. The first indication that this was an issue was in the juror questionnaire when Mr. R, and I'll just use his last name abbreviated, said that he had had a bad experience at Belmont. And there was not very much room in the juror questionnaire, and the juror questionnaire is in the record, in the supplemental record. There was not much room on the form itself to describe that. And so, seeing the juror questionnaire, counsel and the court permitted the in-camera questioning of Mr. R. And Mr. R. said, it's the same thing that you're talking about here. This is after the jury pool has been instructed generally about what the case is about. And he then goes on, as Your Honor indicated, to mention that it's the same thing that happened here. And I don't think Mr. R. specifically said, they killed my father. He didn't say that.
Well, he didn't even say they harmed him. Isn't that your word? Or, I mean, the word that's in the brief?
That's certainly the word that's in the briefs.
Did it come out of his mouth?
The word harm did not come out of his mouth. That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, after we filed our opening brief on this issue, the Supreme Court issued the Novotny case. It's funny how that happens sometimes. There's been discussion in the briefing before the court as to whether that remedial aspect of the Blades decision is still good law or not. We've explained that we think it is, and in a notice of supplemental authority that we filed, I believe, in July, we explained that the division of this court, in a published opinion, had agreed.
We don't have to follow the other divisions of our court, though, do we?
You do not.
And isn't there some logic to the idea that, well, if it could be harmless error where a person's liberty is at stake, it could also be harmless error when a money judgment would be at stake?
I think there is, and that's why cert was granted on whether Blades should remain the law of Colorado. And I fully understand the court's admonition regarding the binding nature or non-binding nature of a panel decisions in this court. But I think that the Morales decision, that we included in our notice of supplemental authority goes through this analysis and explains why the logical underpinnings of Novotny, or the majority of Novotny, don't support a conclusion that Blades has been implicitly overruled for at least two reasons. One, the Novotny majority opinion is based primarily on federal Supreme Court case law moving away from automatic reversible error and going to more of a structural error analysis that doesn't necessarily apply in the civil context. And also the lineage of the rule, the remedial rule in the civil context in this state is over 100 years old, whereas the criminal rule was, I believe, dated from the early 1990s. Certainly, I think that there's a fighter's chance that Blades won't survive. But we think as we stand here today, Blades is still good law. I think it's also important to keep in mind that when the challenge for cause was asserted below, Blades was no doubt still good law, and it had not yet been decided, and therefore counsel did not have an opportunity to create any kind of record that would have supported a argument that there was prejudicial error beyond what Blades required as a matter of law for a number of decades now. If I could just briefly touch upon the cross appeal issues, and I should also clarify, of course, we don't think the court needs to get to the juror bias issue if the court agrees with us on causation, but on the troubling issue, I think the key issue there, troubling the punitive damages, the key issue there is the plain language of the statute. The statute says that the conduct that permits a district court to exercise his or her discretion to enhance punitive damages must occur during the pendency of the case. A case is not pending until it's filed. Counsel for plaintiff has asserted that the standard should be that any conduct post-injury should be the temporal standard, and we don't believe that that's correct. If there are no questions on that, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time if I have any.
Sorry. Thank you, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Jordan Levine. My bar number is 23877. Our main issue for appeal was the last item was discussed by the defendant, and that is the enhancement of punitive damages. We think the law is clear that once the jury has found that punitive damages are warranted by beyond reasonable doubt, the judge then has the discretion to then enhance the punitive damages by 3 times. The court, however, is supposed to look at activity that occurs after the case or during the pendency of the litigation. We submit that the case starts once the negligent act occurs, in this case, when the damages occur, the death. The court at that point is obligated to look at evidence post-trial, evidence that's not necessarily admissible to the jury. I think Your Honor, Justice Webb, the Blood versus Quest case, in that case, punitive damages were enhanced by the jury against Quest for not having a policy of inspection of telephone poles. And on the first page of that decision, it was discussed whether or not the court made an error in not holding a hearing. And in this case, we had evidence of aggravation or more harm to the plaintiff during the pendency of the case, and that the defendant was still engaged in a negligent act of providing very poor catheter care. We submitted 3 state of Colorado reports which found that there was catheter care violations by the same Belmont to a multiple number of patients, and that evidence should have been considered by the judge. And that is also evidence that could have never been submitted to the jury in our case in chief. That wouldn't have been admissible for acts after the negligence had occurred. So we think that the judge, in looking, when he said in his order that no evidence was presented at trial, that he actually should have been making a ruling based on the evidence that was submitted with our motion, and that was the affidavits, or even conducting a hearing and allow the plaintiff to submit evidence.
Did you request a hearing?
We, in our motion, we did not request a hearing. We submitted affidavits of the state reports, but the judge didn't even indicate that he had looked at those reports.
Okay, those reports had been excluded on the defense in limine motion for purposes of the trial.
That's correct.
Did in your motion to increase the punitive damages, did you specifically ask the court to reconsider the in limine ruling and or offer any legal authority why the court should do so?
In that motion, I do not believe we asked the court to reconsider the limine motion. It'd be our position that the limine motion for those state reports would apply to the trial itself, that we couldn't use the evidence of those subsequent acts against other residents in our case to the jury. The jury would not be able to consider that evidence. The judge, however, in looking at whether or not to enhance the punitive damages, that evidence becomes relevant and not prejudicial to the defendant as it would in front of the jury.
Did you make that argument in your motion to the trial court?
I don't believe we made the argument that they would need to revisit it. I think we made the argument, I would submit to you that we made the argument that the court was to consider the evidence of the subsequent acts of poor catheter care. So to answer your question, we didn't ask the judge to go back and renew or revisit his earlier ruling of an limiting motion.
Well, for example, did you explain to the judge that his earlier ruling didn't control consideration of this evidence for purposes of troubling punitives?
Your Honor, I don't have independent recollection on that, and I apologize, but we submit to you that we shouldn't even need to remind the judge of what he's legally required to do. At that point, the plaintiff has a right to submit evidence of the aggravating harm or the continuing conduct. In this case, they still were not providing appropriate catheter care, and that would have been appropriate for the judge to consider in deciding whether or not to enhance the damages.
Did the dates of those reports precede the filing of the action?
The two of the reports were before the suit was filed, but after the negligence in our case.
Yeah. Within that, yeah.
Yes, after our case, those three reports included patients who were provided poor catheter care after the negligent act that was subject matter of this case.
How about before the case was filed?
But before the case was filed. One of them, I believe, was after the case was filed.
Okay.
And moving on to the next issues, because I feel that we won't even get here to enhance punitive damages unless the court finds there was a sufficiency of the evidence in the underlying case, whether or not there was causation. And I think that Your Honor's brought up a good question about whether or not we have to prove that it was a cause or the cause. And the answer is, and the jury instruction said, and this was a standard jury instruction, that we must only prove that it was a cause. And this was really a battle of the experts. This came down to whether or not the jury was going to believe Dr. Leach, who was qualified as an expert in the area of emergency medicine, with over 1,000 patients he had treated for urinary tract infections. More than half of them were in the geriatric population. And against Dr. Schwartz, who was a critical care doctor, qualified also to render an opinion. But the jury got to choose between the two. Dr. Leach was qualified as an expert. He had the experience. His opinions were supported by materials that were provided by the CDC and their definition of what a urinary tract infection was, and whether or not even urinary tract infections can cause death.
Counsel, what about your opponent's claim that Dr. Leach unequivocally conceded that that further care would have prevented her death?
And that is absolutely incorrect, Your Honor. I actually looked up the page number, and actually there might be an error in the page 222. He might be referring to page 221, which I believe was his last answer, and it was only an answer about the urine. And Dr. Leach was clear that when a urinary tract infection goes untreated, it travels from the bladder to the blood, and somebody, and the person would then die of a septic death.
How does he know that? I mean, in the case of Mrs. Albert or Ms. Smith, I'm not sure what her name was, what is the basis for his opinion that she had not just a urinary tract infection, but a blood infection? When, as I understood it, there was no testing, there was no blood testing that showed that.
There was no testing after. That's correct. Right. There was no testing, but this is based on Dr. Leach's experience with over 1,000 cases and how these patients, right, and it goes from an infection into the body.
So that's his opinion, his theory on the case, but there was no underlying objective evidence that showed that this decedent had a blood infection as well as urinary infection.
There was sufficient evidence to show not only that the Ms. Smith had a or Ms. Albert had a urinary tract infection. It was severe and complicated. And there's also support, not only in Dr. Leach's opinion, that the urinary tract infection caused the death, but also Dr. Sloan and the death certificate that was offered by the defendants. Dr. Sloan found that the UTI was a cause of death.
Mm-hmm.
So in the experience that Dr. Leach had in treating these infections, over 1,000 of them in the geriatric population, the CDC also says that there are 13,000 deaths from urinary tract infections per year. Right. And Dr. Sloan's
But the
report.
Mechanism by which it causes death, Dr. Leach only hypothesized here. He couldn't say that there was evidence that a blood infection resulted from the urinary tract infection, because there was no blood cultures, I understand, right?
There was no blood cultures done, correct, but that was a natural progression and how a urinary tract infection progresses, and it was consistent with the symptoms that this patient had. She was obtunded, she had very dark urine, she had large blood in the urine, she had leukocytes, she had ketones, she had casts. there was just an overwhelming amount of evidence to show that this wasn't only a urinary tract infection run-of-the-mill. This was a severe urinary tract infection.
How did you know that she had all those things in her body if there wasn't a blood culture?
There were blood cultures. There was a urinalysis and also a urine culture, which is the gold standard, and nobody argued with that. That was a clear objective evidence of the urinary tract infection and the severity of the urinary tract infection, in addition to the fact that the patient then stopped eating, she started sleeping a lot, and that she was comatose on the day that she was taken back to the hospital. I mean, she had a very severe urinary tract infection from being neglected for days. And based on Dr. Leach's expert opinion and Dr. Sloan's, who have the benefit of seeing the whole course of care and seeing the records and even evaluating the patient for the days before she died, didn't have a question in his mind whether or not the urinary tract infection contributed or was a cause of Ms. Albert's death.
Counsel, why shouldn't the trial court have removed the juror, the prospective juror, for cause?
The we know that it's very well recognized and held that the court has very wide discretion in deciding whether or not to grant a party's challenge for cause.
But we also know that certain times our courts have recognized that certain unconscious influences can undermine a juror's assurance that they could impartially apply the law to the evidence in the case. Why isn't this one of those cases that crosses the line into unconscious influences?
Well, if we look at the statements as a whole of what this juror said in chambers, I think that he clearly showed that he had no bias or enmity against the defendants in this case. He said that in answer to defense counsel's question, do we start behind? The answer is no. That's page 25. Do we factor in your experiences and how you hear the evidence? He said no. He said, I don't know, I don't think this will sway me. That's page 27. He doesn't have biases against nursing homes in general. He just said that he has concerns if he ever ended up in one, which I think everybody has. The judge asked him if he'd be able to set aside his opinions, whether or not he'd be able to hear the evidence. He again said, I think I would be able to. It was a consistent theme through the answering of the judge's questions, opposing counsel questions, and even my questions.
Was there any hesitation or any doubt expressed at any time by this prospective juror?
No, Your Honor, there wasn't. He showed no enmity against Belmont altogether. There was no evidence that of Belmont's negligence, even if there was any, in this juror's father's care, led to any lawsuit or led to any injury or any harm. He just said that his father and his father's roommate had contracted a UTI. His experience with UTIs, however, goes against the plaintiff because he never really saw that a UTI led to a death. He knew that it could, but he never saw that it could. He thought that it was easily treated. So he fell right in the middle. And defense counsel had ample opportunity to question him. And all of his answers, very consistent, thought that he could be fair, that he could put all of his experiences aside, and not that they were even that bad, but he can put them aside and know and be open to hearing the evidence in this case. And the court was satisfied after conducting a little bit of an inquiry of their own that this juror could be fair. And there are several cases, I mean, the cases where they actually found jurors to be, where the judge abused the discretion was a case where it was a juror whose daughter might have been confronted by the defendant, and the defendant may have stolen a knife from that juror, potential juror's daughter, to use it in the crime of which she was being accused. I mean, that was beyond, that was an abuse of discretion. I mean, this juror had connection to the defendant. This was a violent crime. And in this case, the only connection was that this potential juror's father was in the nursing home for a period of time. And the father of this juror had passed away, and there's no connection between Belmont's acts and the father's death, and that was never discussed in the voir dire. That was in chambers. One last thing that I'd like to mention, if I answer your questions on the juror's qualification, is that any time that the defendant brings up opinions by Dr. Schwartz as it pertains to any one of the causes, whether it's legal cause or factual cause, the jury outright rejected Dr. Schwartz's testimony in its entirety. Dr. Schwartz was the only doctor to testify that Ms. Albert did not have, I'm sorry, Janet Smith did not have a urinary tract infection. He was the only physician to say that. The doctor, the urinalysis showed it, that she had a severe UTI. The culture showed it.
Even after the treatment of the, with the antibiotics, did she still have a urinary tract infection?
The doctor, Dr. Leach, addressed that, and he said that you can clear it from the bladder, but once it leaves the bladder and it's a severe infection, you can clear up the bladder and you can clear up the urine, but it didn't necessarily clear up the infection. And again, you've got the two doctors, Dr. Leach and Dr. Sloan, both saying that the UTI was a cause of Janet Smith's death. Dr. Schwartz.
He said since the urine was cleared, the UTI was cleared up. That was Dr. Schwartz's opinion.
Dr. Schwartz said that Ms. Smith never had. Against the CDC requirements, his reasoning was that the patient never complained of flank or costocubital pain. The patient was comatose. The jury just outright rejected anything that Dr. Schwartz had to say, because really it was outrageous to say that not even a UTI, when the blood, the objective evidence clearly showed, even if there wasn't any testimony by any physician, the objective evidence clearly showed that she was suffering from a UTI and was very, very ill.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments in this case. The case will stand submitted and continue to issue due course. We